welcome to a very special edition of Liberty Blue Conversations. Joining the show, one of the few Islander fans I enjoy talking to, genuinely enjoy talking to, one of the co-hosts of Skates at the Stakes. I had to practice. That's a real tongue twister there. I've definitely said it the other way around more than once. How are we doing, Ryan?
Hey, everyone. How's it going? I'm excited to be on tonight. I am the polar bear in Arlington, Texas right now of this podcast. As you know, you might know me from Islanders Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Brad Martin. I also have a podcast, Skates at the Stakes, covering the New York Islanders. But, you know, happy to be, as Nick gave me a kind compliment there, on with one of the, you know, best Rangers fans I know tonight to talk a little puck. So very excited to get going here.
All right. So coming into the season, I kind of felt like I understood who the Islanders were. And then we actually started the season and I had no idea who the Islanders were. What would you chalk up to that very weird first half? Was it very much as simple as Lane Lambert not being good at his job? Or is that like the easy way out answer of understanding what didn't work the first, you know, 40, 50 games?
It's a weird dynamic what happened. Like, obviously Lambert's at fault. I was always kinder on Lambert than other people because, like, I think he was a high character guy. He didn't seem like a bad person. He just seemed like he was in way over his head, and his assistants weren't helping either. The Islanders, for the first time in my life, had a really good power play, and everyone was really excited about that, but they were just leaking goals on the penalty kill. I think they had a historically bad penalty kill at one point in the season, and they couldn't get their starting six defensemen all healthy at the same time, and the team suffered a lot of issues with having very light organizational defensive depth, which led for them acquiring Robert Bortuzzo and Mike Riley at points in the season. So, you know, when Adam Pellick, I think, was out for a while, Ryan Pulock was out for a while, Scott Mayfield was out for a while, they were down, you know, to the seventh, eighth, ninth man in the org. And it was really brutal watching every night.
So in understanding their summer, I didn't necessarily agree with the decisions, but I understood them. As far as, you know, Engvall, Mayfield, Varlamov, I understand that the Islanders are kind of in the window where if they start to unwind their position, like if they had let those guys go, there wasn't really a point to doing that. So I understand a lot of people's confusion at giving, especially the term on some of those deals. But as far as the logic behind them, they make sense. So in building out this team, when everything is going right, in your mind, what does that look like? What is the 2023-24 Islanders look like success-wise? What does that look like in terms of style, how they're playing, who's playing important roles?
Yeah, I think the way Lamoriello built this team, which, you know, we could talk about the deals in a moment, but the way he built the team was to be reflective of what they were at the end of last season with Horvat, an injured Matt Barzal, but they were pacing to be like a 102-point team down the stretch. Everyone had already sold off at that point. That's the important caveat to make there. But they were able to take care of business. So I think the way Lou built the team was to be in like the 96, 97 point percentage like pace and then acquire big at the deadline again, just to keep going for it and keep the cycle open of doing that every year. But that's what I think it looks like when it's supposed to be working well. They overestimated Engvall. They thought he was a top six forward. I think he's a third line forward. He's actually a pretty good and fun to watch third line forward. But, you know, they thought he was going to be reliable in the top six. He wasn't. And then, you know, you also have a guy like Scott Mayfield, who is a good playoff defenseman, but that guy has to make it through 82 games every year. And he's not going to look good every one of those 82 games. So, you know, it becomes real big problem. Varlamov held up really well this year. So that was the deal from last summer. But, you know, they didn't bring in any real talent in. We have, your listeners are going to be very familiar with the Julien Gauthier dilemma. So maybe we could get into that.
Gauthier is fascinating because when you watch him play, he looks like an NHL player. He's big. He's fast. He has okay puck skills. But when it comes to actually putting the puck in the net, he has no idea what he's doing. He's the quintessential quadruple A guy. You know, I always felt the Rangers didn't give him enough of a look on the fourth line. And their logic was, well, he's not good at defense. But he can skate and he is big. There are worse things you can have on your fourth line. I mean, you're a veteran of the Ross Johnston Wars. You understand that there are a lot worse guys you can have on your fourth line than someone like Gauthier.
Yeah, it just depends on how progressive you want to get with it. And Lambert obviously wasn't progressive. He kept the Clutterbuck, Cizikas, Martin fourth line every single game as it's now kind of far. You know, Martin's over the hill. Clutterbuck is probably a bottom 25 percentile player in this league, especially on the penalty kill. And then Cizikas is still like, you know, bottom 30 percentile player in the league, 40 percentile. But, you know, they're all washed up, and he, Lambert wouldn't give a real shot for, you know, Gauthier to get a fourth line shot. Wahlstrom, which people have various opinions on. I think the book's out kind of at this point. But, you know, people still think that you could just plug and play Oliver Wahlstrom at this point, which is pretty funny. But, yeah, it's just, you know, we had a coach who was pretty set in his ways. He learned from Barry Trotz, and I don't think he learned the important things from Barry Trotz. I think he didn't understand a lot of the character stuff that Trotz brought to the organization, and didn't understand a lot of the deployment that Trotz used during his time here.
Understanding this team, I watch a decent bit of the Islanders, both being that my girlfriend is an Islander fan, and both just tri-state area, they're on TV. I'm going to watch hockey when they're on. I feel like the highs are awesome. Like, they murdered the Bruins last Saturday. They absolutely beat the crap out of them. But they've also had duds. And in understanding this transition from Lambert to Waugh, what do you feel like as far as on ice is the biggest difference between the two and trying to get more consistent? Because I feel like that's been the Islanders' issue, especially through the first half of the season, is just a lack of consistency.
Yeah, it's definitely consistency. One, it's being healthy. Getting Ryan Pulock and Adam Pellick back is a big help for the team. Controlling shot share is something that they've done under Waugh. And like, I think the 12 games now, they've controlled shot share almost every game. Still haven't planned to play like Carolina or Corsi team, so we'll leave that where it is. But like against the Bruins, they controlled shots. They are, you know, controlling play a lot better when, you know, at times Lambert was still doing a lot of the duck and cover rush chances that Trotz was doing, but Trotz had a lot better of an, or much more effective defensive structure. But then when you go towards kind of the big point here is they're getting the goaltending again, which is really good. But also, not to just say it's like a better mentality in the room, but it feels a lot better with Patrick Waugh in the room than Lane Lambert. Lane Lambert was a little bit of a dud to the media and, you know, going forward. So it's just nice having a little bit of a better vibe associated with the team. The coaching change came way too late in the season, but apparently Waugh had suitors from like Ottawa. I know Ottawa Kiprio said that they were in on him, but I don't know, you know, he could have taken a job later in the year with the Kings or something, who knows. But, you know, definitely a really good guy to have in the locker room. And it's been a lot of fun being the Patrick Waugh team.
Speaking of the power play, you brought it up. You're right. This is the first time in a real long time that the Islanders' power play is working and reasonably well. I mean, when they went to the conference finals consecutive years, their power play was either Barzal skate the puck around the perimeter of the offensive zone and wait for a jam play at the net front, or set up Pulock on the one-timer. And God bless Ryan Pulock. He's a good hockey player, but he doesn't hit the net all that often, which is a really important requisite when you're the primary read on the power play. What's different about the power play this year, and why is it working so much better? Is this just simply, you know, better structure, or is there something more to it than that?
It's Bo Horvat. I mean, that's the easiest way to put it. Bo's been awesome. You know, originally they brought in Pageau to play this similar role where it would be Barzal skating around the perimeter and having someone strong in the slot who can get a shot off. Pageau messed up his hand in the bubble and has never really been the same since. If the Ottawa Senators, if you're listening right now, his hand is fine. If the Anaheim Ducks are listening, his hand's fine. But also if you're listening at home, his hand's not fine. And he's had a really difficult time getting his shot off, Pageau. I don't think he's lifted a puck now in two seasons. So getting him off the first power play, not really rotating it as much. Under Lambert, there was the story that apparently they just got together on the plane and started drawing stuff on the back of napkins. Palmieri, Horvat, Barzal, Dobson, and I believe the other one would be Brock Nelson. And they just started drawing stuff up in the back of the plane one day. I think Butch said that on TV once. And, you know, it's been really effective. They have a lot of good chemistry. I don't know if getting Anders Lee off the first unit's a big help and having Palmieri be the net front guy, but it's definitely a different dynamic and everything's kind of plugging away right now, which is awesome.
You mentioned both Palmieri and Brock Nelson. I want to start with Brock and we'll get to Palmieri in a second. What would you attribute his, I don't want to call it like a renaissance because Brock's always been a good player, but he turned 30 and then became, you know, one of the 5-10 best second line centers in the entire league. Is this just a matter of maturing and just getting a better understanding of what you need to do? Or is there something deeper to Brock's goal scoring prowess as he's gotten older?
Yeah, it's I always comp Brock a lot to Joe Pavelski, except without the NetFront game, where they both got criticized a lot, you know, in those kind of NBC era of hockey for not being as hard on the boards and not being tough enough, really. Brock got it pretty bad from Islanders fans for a while. But you just see as they get older and their shots, you know, are still mature, they kind of are able to build on their kind of game with age and keep improving. Brock is such a silky smooth shot and some really good handles too. But like, he's able to just keep putting it together. It's absolutely awesome. And he's not playing a physical game, so you see with him that there's a lot of longevity. He's, I think, 33 right now. He still looks like he's going to be this good till 35, 36, which is absolutely awesome. But yeah, no, he feels like Pavelski. And on the Palmieri point, you know, Palm's been really good under Watts. It's been awesome to see.
Yeah, no, Palmieri is fascinating in that you look at his game, you look at his numbers, he's never really jumped off the page, never been the best player on his own team, probably never been the second best player on his own team at the NHL level, but Lou's insistence on getting the guys he's familiar with, the guys he has pre-existing relationships with, for all the warts, there are occasionally mishaps with that. It really didn't work in Toronto with that, but with the Islanders, there's been moments where it's really worked out for them. Coming into the season, that second line of Palmieri, Brock Nelson, and Engvall, they came out of the gate really hot. They really looked good. The underlings were good. They were driving play. They were holding the puck a lot. And then it kind of fell apart. What would you attribute that second line kind of falling apart? I shouldn't say falling apart, but just not working as well after about the first month or so of the season.
Yeah, their underlings are incredible. And, you know, maybe a future guest for you, but if you're on Islanders Twitter, Stats by Zach has like great post-game breakdowns of all the underlings per model. And, you know, they were just dominant almost every game the first half season, but they weren't putting the puck in the back of the net enough that really reflected the underlings. So, you know, Engvall starts turning the puck over and Lambert starts scratching him. You know, you're one of a seven-year deal. You don't want to see that. But like that was pretty brutal. And Engvall was losing confidence fast. But like, you know, Palmieri and Nelson have really good chemistry, but someone on that line has to be the guy with, you know, taking the shot. And the two best shooters on the same line on the team, you'd think it would work a lot better than it did. But Engvall isn't really a distributor as much as just a good puck possession player. He's not a, you know, elite passer like Barzal is on the first line. He's just, you know, he's an okay passer and he can keep the puck away from the other team. But, you know, it's just two guys that I think want to be shooting in Nelson and Palmieri, and then no one really doing a great job of getting the puck to him unless Dobson was on the ice.
So you mentioned him and we'll touch on, there's a lot to unpack with the Islanders because I feel like their season's been so interesting. As far as, you know, about a month ago, and this wasn't, I would say, a popular opinion, but a vocal opinion. There was real conjecture about it's not going to happen for them this year. Maybe we should look at unwinding our position to some degree. Maybe we should have some conversations about guys who have term. And the reason I never really ascribed that it was feasible was then what? So if you trade Brock Nelson, what, you're going to get prospects or a roster player? None of those guys is going to be impactful as Brock Nelson. And the thing about it is the rest of the core is, for the most part, in that late 20s age bracket, you know, guys 27, 28, 29. So they don't really, it doesn't behoove them to wait 2 or 3 years. Was there ever a point where you felt like a sell-off, not even a sell-off, but maybe a tweak or a retool of the way the roster's put together was feasible?
Yeah, we got really down bad on the Skates and Stakes podcast over the past 2 months where, you know, the team this year and the point we keep getting back to is this year is the we're back, it's over Islanders where the team just is in a constant loop of, you know, 4 or 5 really good wins or a 10-game point streak and then like a 6-game losing streak where they are blowing leads in 4 of the 6 and it's just brutal to watch. But yeah, no, entertaining a Brock trade is way different than wanting one, I would say. Like, you know, when you start thinking about it, obviously the first thought is, okay, it's, you know, every hockey trade's the same thing. Like, I don't want to surprise anyone here, but when you're selling a player on your team, you're expecting a first round pick, a good prospect, and a roster player. Then you go around and look through like a top 100 prospects list and you're like, all right, well, we're starting at like number 50 here. We're not getting a top 50 guy. It doesn't really make sense. Like, Brock's going to have a lot of positional value the next 2 years as a 2C. You're basically punting on 2025 anyway, and then boom, Bo Horvat's 31. Like, if you blink, you miss it with this group. So you might as well just keep going for it. Not like as a cry to trade your first round pick this year, but like with Brock Nelson, one, you're just trying to look to recreate that value that he gives to the lineup as kind of one of the better goal scorers in the league. I'd probably say top 30 ish, top 40. And then you're trying to basically one, recreate that, two, hope that whatever's coming is going to be able to recreate that. And then three would be, at a really good point. I'm trying to remember what I made. Basically what I'm trying to say here is, you know, you're trying to reset the timeline and you're trying not to miss out on this group.
That's a really interesting point. One of my best friends, she's a lunatic Islanders fan. And I remember being at a game sitting there with her last year, second half of the season after they had traded for Horvat, and they were kind of limping along. They didn't really get going, I would say, until, you know, early March. And she looked at me and said, Nick, the only reason they traded for Bo Horvat is they really wanted to make the playoffs this year because they just opened the new building. Do you think there's, being that, you know, this ownership group is still relatively new, they just got the building open in the last couple of years, do you think that there is a degree of, you know, ownership kind of nudging them in the direction of not wanting a sell-off? Or do you think that that's giving Lou too much charity or being too deferential that he isn't the one who wants to do this?
Well, if you're sitting down, there's a long history of New York Islanders ownership. I think, you know, they're in really good hands. We just celebrated the anniversary of John Spano lately, I think a couple of weeks ago now. But the team's had some awful owners, three owners sent to prison since, I think, 1995, which is an awesome statistic. But it's like the thing to say about this ownership group is, one, they're very focused on getting people to the arena. It's not a traditional hockey market, you know, in the sense of they do have the cups in the 80s. But they're also trying to build a sustainable hockey market where they're not going to be falling under, you know, 80% building capacity and the team is bad. They're also trying to build the retail village, which is a really big part of this, as they have a state-of-the-art retail complex coming at Belmont Park. And then the third aspect of that is going to be the All-Star Game in 2 years, which they're going to want to have some hype and buzz around the All-Star Game. You know, people are obviously going to come in from all over the country and North America as a whole, to even Europe, obviously. But to come see the All-Star Game. And they're going to want to have the retail village up and running in the next 2 years to be able to support that. So it's going to be really big. And, you know, how you support that retail village and how you get everything going, you got to have a winning hockey team on the ice and you got to be putting butts in seats. So I do give Lou, like, they went to Lou Lamoriello knowing he was the guy to do this, but it's kind of a chicken or egg situation, as you were talking about, where Lou's coming to be the guy to get the team to contention for 6 or 7 years, which, you know, getting to contention isn't too hard in the NHL. It's getting to that next level, which I don't think Lou's able to do anymore. But, you know, it's just part about being a weird Lou Lamoriello team.
It's interesting you bring that up, because I was talking about this with somebody the other day, that it feels like the Islanders are good enough to get to the playoffs consistently, but a lot of whatever happens to them in the playoffs is largely on just, you know, their three or four elite players kind of elevating their game. I mean, when they went to the conference finals a couple of years ago, I mean, I was pretty convinced Adam Pellick was going to be one of the 5-10 best defensemen in the entire league at that point. And he's had a lot of injuries, so it's not really fair to criticize his deterioration / fall off to just not being good anymore. But he's had a lot of injuries. How do you feel in terms of that trade-off? You know, instead of, you know, maybe taking a step back, being meh for a year or two and kind of tinkering around the edges to try and get the right mix, how does it make you feel that they're consistently trying to get in and then anything can happen once you get in? And they'll point to teams like Florida. They'll point to teams at like inaugural Vegas, the Blues, the Capitals, that it's doable, but it's unlikely.
It's tough because they did have that year in 2021 or 2022 where they missed the playoffs. And
that was the year from hell, you know, too. That wasn't even really
that was the year from hell. It wasn't completely their fault. I mean, now if you listen to a lot of, like, you know, it kind of gets thrown out what happened with the COVID and everything with that team. But they missed the playoffs that year. If they were going to pull the needle on the grenade and just blow it up, that would have been the time to do it. Then they dug in, they committed to the core, they re-signed Barzal. I think there was some kind of handshake agreement there that we're going to get some offensive talent around you. We're going to open up the system to Barzal and make you the face of the franchise, which, I mean, you know, Matt Barzal, beautiful player. I know he's personally one of your favorite players to watch.
Yeah.
He's absolutely awesome. Like he's a ton of fun out there, but like they opened it up, they made him the guy. If he's the guy on a title team, that's a different conversation, but they put a lot of talent around him to support him and they've committed to the goalie now. So for the next 8 years, the strategy will be basically make it to the playoffs and then hope Ilya gets hot. And, you know, that in a sense could remind you of the early 2000s Rangers.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a lot of people are 2010 Rangers. People say that, It's definitely a way of going about it. I know there's a lot of teams that hit the floor on tanks, which I think is the easiest thing in the sport to do, to hit the floor. It's just rebuilding yourself back up to even that contention level that becomes very difficult, as well as hitting that next level to a championship team.
They have come on strong as of late. They had the nice win the other night. They beat the Bruins over the weekend. It feels like the Flyers are kind of slowly falling off the pace. It doesn't feel like the Devils or the Penguins or anyone behind them is going to be able to really make a push. It really does kind of feel academic that the Islanders are going to get in. As far as ceiling, floor, all that, I still want to see what they do at the deadline, and we'll talk about the deadline in a minute. But as far as coming into the season, where they're at now, do you feel like, even with all the turmoil, that they're reasonably close? You know, they're within their margin of error for total outcomes for the season?
I think they, this far in the season, they've got a bottom 25% outcome and they're still in the race because of factors outside of their hands. I mean, you know, if Pittsburgh was the Renaissance painting, as I'll often tweet, if this team had worked as designed as in Pittsburgh, which, you know, that's the other school of roster construction, is relying on three or four truly, truly elite players and then just hoping that everything else carries them kind of to the playoffs. And then from there, the elite players will keep carrying them from there. That happened in Pittsburgh. The Devils had a lot of bad injury luck and, you know, just never righted the ship on goaltending, which I'm a goaltending truther, but I know a lot of people, you know, will think it's replaceable. The Carolina model of doing business, I think you have to have a good goaltender back there and a capable backup, but that's just me. It bit the Devils in the face this year. We'll see if it keep biting them going forward. But, you know, for the Islanders, they've gotten a bottom 30% outcome with their team. Like, if you're firing your coach midseason, things have gone horribly wrong and you should not be in the playoff race. And they're still, like, hanging out in ninth, probably, you know, two games in hand on the Lightning at the moment and two games in hand on the Flyers. Could even catch Detroit for the 7, but that's probably an unlikely outcome. Somehow this team's been able to, you know, piece it together just because no one around them is really taking the bull by the horns, as we've seen in the East a couple times in the past few years, where it's a 100-point pace to get in. I think this year's only going to be like 93 or 94.
It's really interesting because we always talk about the Metro being really condensed, that yeah, some teams are more talented. Like I would say the Devils, the Rangers, you know, they have more talent than the rest of the teams, but everybody always plays each other generally well, and it keeps everybody congested. There's not a huge gap between everybody. And I think for a team like the Islanders, that is this year in particular, that's riding on the power play, a handful of guys, and Sorokin slowly but surely starting to get it together, I think as long as you stay in the mix, you have as good a chance of anybody. I mean, you brought up Carolina. I mean, I was a Carolina truther for a long time. I have since rehabilitated said opinion for one of the reasons you said they never value goaltending and they are content to try and facsimile good goaltending. But it feels like if you have that goalie, and you alluded to it before, say comparing this iteration of the Islanders to like the early 2010s Rangers, if you got one of the five guys that is better than everybody they play, you know, 60, 70 games a year, that goes a long way. And Sorokin hasn't been great this year, but he's getting there. And that, I think, really speaks to what you were saying before about lowest range of outcomes. They're where they are right now with arguably their best or second best player playing pretty poorly. So I think if they get the goaltending going, and we're going to touch on the deadline in a second, if they really get Sorokin on a nice groove, they're really going to be set up to kind of go into the playoffs with some momentum, which does matter.
Absolutely, especially if you're coming in a lower seed and going to play road first round. I mean, there was a couple of years back where all the wildcard teams just basically swept the first round because, you know, the top seeds, either it's rest or rust or complacency or whatever it is. But, you know, in the NHL, it's the highest variance league, and that's part of why we love it. I mean, love it and hate it to an extent, but, you know, it's the highest variance league. If you're in a playoff series, the team that has 120-point Boston Bruins and the team that has 92-point Florida Panthers, it's still a 60-40 split. Who's going to win the series, no matter kind of what analytical model's telling you. You know, I know the Toronto Maple Leafs broke the model one year at a 92% chance to beat the Montreal Canadiens in the first round. And then, you know, that's hockey, baby. It's just a high variance sport, and that's why we enjoy it. That's why a team like the Islanders can kind of stay constructed as they are and have a chance at winning it all. But at the end of the day, to win four rounds the way they're currently built is a really difficult task. So
how do you feel about the deadline from the perspective of operating in silence? That's a staple of Lou, and we'll talk about specific guys in a second, but as a fan, how does it make you feel to sit in this space where you basically have no idea what your team is going to do or if your team is doing anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, there's some incredibly leaky teams in this league. You know, you see Vancouver leaking out that they're going to flip their rental that they just got a couple weeks previously. That's like the funniest stuff to me, that there are like Vancouver's a traditionally leaky front office, Calgary, teams like that. The Islanders have basically five people on the beat staff, so it's not like they're really challenging Lou too much to break the cone of silence, but he's historically held it now for like 30 years. And I've always been fine being a Lamoriello team in terms of the cone of silence. I mean, the facial hair and everything else, that's completely different conversation, and mileage varies on that. But like for the, you know, cone of silence, I'm fine operating in a silo. The Horvat trade, it was like 6 p.m. I was at work and I read it come across my desk and I was like, holy cow. And I was like marking out at my desk at work and there was like nothing besides a Reddit post leading towards the biggest trade of the deadline. But at the same time, there'll be times, let's try to think, the Pageau trade, there was a little smoke too because it was Ottawa and that was a leaky front office. The Palmieri trade happened right after a game. No one really knew about it. And then the Horvat trade, there was like something on Reddit earlier in the day and then nothing else until it actually happened. I'm okay if Lou, like, you know, the hope here is he doesn't do anything crazy and keeps the first round pick. So I'm hoping that nothing kind of shocks me this year. But, you know, as we sit here at 8:52 on the 6th with 2 days to go left for the deadline, things are looking good that Lou's kind of not going to go crazy this year. So, you know, that's the hope.
Is there an argument to go crazy being that the East is so wide open and the Islanders are slowly but surely improving? Because I know I was talking with Ethan earlier and he was pretty – he felt – if they got someone like Duclair and maybe a depth defenseman, that would be a fine deadline. Do you think there's an argument for going a little bigger than that? Or is it not worth it based on what you've seen so far?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as we talked about, the historically bad penalty kill is still, you know, non-historically bad. It's still not good. So we're dealing with that. I'm hoping that maybe they can bring in a bottom sixer to push Martin out of the lineup, maybe even two bottom sixers to push Clutterbuck as well out of the lineup and seeing if that improves the team, kind of take out some of the worst parts and hope that everything else rises to the top. You know, they built a good culture with those guys, but it's kind of time to, you know, either take LTIR to ride out your contract or, you know, ride in the press box for a bit. But overall, I mean, I think that, you know, they were looking at some of the lower risk guys or hoping they were looking at them, being Adam Henrique, Sam Carrick, guys like that, but they're on the right Edmonton. So they might have missed the boat on those guys. I know Vetrano's still out there. I've heard, like, you know, just from reading Arthur Staples' article this week, I think they're in on maybe like some of the guys on the Sharks, like Cunin, Barabanov. I don't think they're looking at a goal scorer because I think they finally, for the first time of this Lamoriello era, figured out goal scoring.
You mentioned Horvat and the trade, and just conceptually, it made sense. You know, they needed to get Barzal somebody of his ilk. I think that was really the issue when they were going on those conference finals runs, was they didn't have that one more guy, you know, and we can do the woulda, coulda, shoulda, or if they just had this, just had that. But it feels like they finally gave Barzal a good complementary piece, and they play so well off of each other that it feels kind of crazy it took this long to find someone. And I understand, you know, that's what makes Bo Horvat good. There just aren't a lot of guys that are that good. But putting them together and moving Barzal off center, which, you know, that was a point of conjecture for a while, it feels like they kind of should have gotten here a little bit sooner.
Yeah, they probably could have all those years with Trotz, put Barzal on Nelson's wing and made it work like that, but they just never went that route. I mean, it's a lot of things this year. It's especially the rise of Noah Dobson finally hitting that next level, which is huge for this team. But having Barzal on Horvat's wing and just having a really effective first line for the first time since 91 left, it's absolutely awesome watching it happen. It's a ton of fun, this kind of first line that they finally put Bo and Barzy together. Horvat was considered probably one of the best 2 seasons in the league, and he's probably a, you know, top 50 percentile, like, you know, 1C, I'd say. He's pretty good, and Barzal just makes him better. So it's an absolutely awesome combo. It's been really fun watching them grow together this year. Should they have hit it sooner? Probably, but, you know, they were pretty comfortable when they extended Anders Lee and stuff. They were, you know, going for it with this group. They missed out on Panarin. They missed out on I wouldn't say they missed out really on Goudreau, but they definitely probably tried there. They tried for Barzal a couple of times, but then at the end of the day, all it took was kind of a huge trade where they took a bet that Atu Ratu wasn't as good as the organization at that point thought he was. And, you know, they wound up to this point making out pretty well in the trade, which winds up being a win-win for both teams.
How do you feel about the mystery box proposition? Because that's what that is. You know, you mentioned it, what the package looks like, the first round pick, the roster player, a mid-level prospect. And if it's a really good player, one more asset. Because, you know, you look at what we still don't know what Hanifin went for to Vegas, but you look at that, you look at what Mantha got, you look at what Tarasenko got. And it feels like everybody is just either really undervalued or it feels like assets don't have any value. And I struggle with that because we all watch the games. We all put a lot of time in understanding the data, and it still feels like the market never matches opinions on players. Because I was talking to people earlier in the week, and everybody's like, if Mantha goes to the right team, he's going to be a really impactful player in the playoffs. And he went for draft picks like 3 years from now.
Yeah, 3 years from now and like a couple days early before you even have to meet the deadline. So it's like I listen to a lot of baseball podcasts, and the common theme is teams will tell you what they think of their prospects by the way they treat them. And that's what you see at the NHL trade deadline every year. Guys that are made expendable, even if they're on some top 25, top 30 list, you know, teams are going to let you know what they think of a player's talent level by how they treat them. And then the other team's kind of going to make it their job to, you know, either make the player better within their own system or sell their fans that the player is actually a good move. I remember I point to this trade all the time on Skates at the Stakes. It's even getting me now. But I point to the trade, which was the Verona first round pick, second round pick, third round pick for Anthony Mantha trade. From I think it was Detroit made the trade with Washington. It seemed like, you know, Detroit or he'd had just given up like very little to get a lot. And for both teams, it winds up being kind of a lose-lose down the road, or like moderate game to moderate game. So it's tough. I mean, you're making deals and you're trying to sell your fans on these deals, but sometimes they just wind up being nothing burgers. Ratu, they bet that he wasn't gonna be great. And he wound up not being great. They burned the ELC on the last day. That's the funniest part of it. They burned the first year of his ELC the day before because Vancouver didn't finalize the deal. But, you know, Vancouver got sold on 2 weeks of prospect, and it might be a bill of goods. I mean, I see their fans trying to shop him to another team this deadline. The first round pick wound up getting them Hronek, which is a great trade, and that's, you know, really been franchise altering for them this year. And then, you know, Anthony Beauvillier wound up being what we thought Anthony Beauvillier was in the regular season, and he never got a chance to prove in the playoffs over there.
Beauvillier is fascinating because, A, as you mentioned, noted good playoff player, and he always kills the Rangers. He's, I want to say, 23 points in 29 career games against the Rangers. And this is somebody who in his career is, you know, like 0.4 points per game for his life. I think the Islanders, as an organization, I think they do a really good job of identifying guys and knowing exactly what to do with them. Sure, occasionally they miscast, as you alluded to earlier. The identity line isn't what it used to be. But, you know, guys like Holmstrom, guys like Fasching, who they're nothing crazy, but those are dependable NHL guys. They're cheap, and they're good, frankly, for their roles. Help McLean. Why wasn't McLean up a month ago? In the game on Saturday night against the Bruins, he looked actively good on the ice at the same time as guys like Brad Marchand and David Pastrnak.
Yeah, no, it's interesting how developments worked for the team, because everyone blamed Brent Thompson for the longest time. And, you know, I'm guilty of it as well. They just, you know, never had too many high-end prospects. They messed up the wave of Bellows and Hosang, which was probably it for Gard Snow. But they nailed Beauvillier, they nailed Barzal. And then drafting, they just didn't have first-round picks throughout the Lamoriello era besides Holmstrom. So it's just been like, you know, finding dependable depth guys, which sometimes that's all you need. Sometimes you could just get the top six guys from other places. I think it's a cool element of team building that the Islanders have been doing, especially with the Romanov first round pick trade, where they're able to get, you know, guys in their mid to late 20s. Romanov would be the exception, being really young, but just being able to flip these picks and being able to get youngish players and then extending them as a part of the long-term future. It's pretty good. I mean, I don't hate it as a team building strategy. I know some Islanders fans despise it. They think like, oh, they're bringing the team to the ground, which, you know, if they have to go scorched earth in 5 or 6 years when the Sorokin deal starts to end, that they go scorched earth at that point. At that point, you're already at the bottom, so there's nowhere else to go. So that's kind of where the team sits right now. I'm all in favor for going for it in the interim. I'd like to have a first-round pick or a prospect just to wind up, you know, not on the 32nd spot on all these lists every year, but like, or to have something coming in the pipeline so you don't have to just leverage your future every deadline. But, you know, it's interesting just seeing the direction they go. But they do want pick out a lot of undervalued guys, and Beauvillier is definitely a weird case.
You mentioned Dobson earlier, and his jump this year has been nothing short of incredible. I mean, the talent has always been there. You know, that archetype, the puck handling right-handed defenseman who has some offense, is the unicorn. You know, every franchise is looking for that guy. And him and Evan Bouchard, the guy in the Oilers, they both came into the league about the same time, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. And the Islanders and the Oilers both extremely slow played their development. You know, Dobson played with 44-year-old Chara for a season. They just didn't look good together. But it feels like both the Islanders knew the talent was there, but they slow played it so that they didn't put too much on his plate too fast. And now I don't think there's an argument. He's clearly the Islanders' best defenseman and arguably their second or third most important player on the entire team.
Yeah, Noah's been awesome this year. I mean, look, if you want to take credit for it, it is because we all bullied him on Twitter and then he blocked us all and that whole kerfuffle. But no, like we made him into the man he is today. He could thank us later, send us, you know, throw flowers at us from the parade boat going down to Hempstead Turnpike. But he's funny, man. He had that ordeal. Well, the way he broke in the league was he was basically shadowing Andy Green. He wasn't showing the offensive upside that he did in juniors at first. But, you know, with young defensemen, I like to give them 50 to 100 games to get their feet wet, which, you know, it might be a little too generous, but I want Noah to get his feet wet. He goes into that year with Zdeno Chara, the injury year and the COVID year. He winds up playing the whole season, and he contributes 50 points for the first time in his career, and it looks like he's breaking through. But then last year, he was analytically one of the worst defensemen in the league. He still got his with the point scoring. He still got his 50, but he did not look like he was going to be capable of defending. It was starting to give Shane Goss's bear vibes. And then, you know, this year he just comes right out of the gate and it's like, oh, Noah has 3 points in 2 games. Oh, Noah has 10 points in 7 games. Oh, Noah has 20 points in 16 games. Do we have like Mike Green 2.0 on our hands? I'm like, oh my God, what are we doing here? And then Noah just keeps going and going this season. It's absolutely awesome. I think it's the power play improvement, obviously, being the quarterback, which he always showed flashes that he'd be like a truly elite power play quarterback. He was comped to Petrangelo at the time of the draft. And I think if that comes into play, that's an absolutely awesome piece for this team to have. And I think they have to lock him up this summer, which is going to be a fun negotiation, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, he definitely jumped from being like a $5 million defenseman to probably closer to $8 or $9 million without the full body of work to prove that. So we'll see what happens with Noah, but it's a great problem to have.
It really is. And still on the subject of Dobson, I know the big frustration with him is he's big, but he doesn't play like it. He's relatively easy to get off of the puck. He does turn the puck over a decent amount. But I think the part of that people miss is when you are a good player, you're going to have the puck more often than other people. I mean, Erik Karlsson was the best defenseman in the world for 2 or 3 years there in Ottawa, and he would consistently lead the league in turnovers. That's not to say turnovers aren't bad, but I think people kind of miss the forest for the trees when they harp on things like turnovers, especially in regards to a defenseman who's going to have the puck a ton.
Yeah, Noah's turnovers, like, they were always very high, and, you know, he definitely was careless with the puck, just being a young defenseman and all. He was thrown right into the top four once he started to show flashes, so it was like being overexposed to him really quickly. And, you know, you take the Bouchard path in Ottawa or Edmonton, where they have two of the best players in the world with him. He was immediately expected to be the offensive defenseman of this team, while also kind of undergoing some of the defensive struggles they've had with Pelech, kind of regressing the past few years, Pulak coming back to earth, where those guys were coming back to earth. And also the plan originally was for him and Romanov to be paired together, where Romanov would be the left-sided defensive defenseman, Dobson offense on the right. And the way it came out was Romanov was all defense, Dobson was all offense, and just couldn't meet in the middle. This year, they finally met in the middle, and they look awesome together, but it's taken a while to get there.
So looking ahead now, we're recording this Wednesday night, deadline's in day and a half-ish. Is there anybody specific you really like for the Islanders ahead of the deadline?
No one truly specific. I mean, if they wind up getting Vetrano out of all this, and they're the team where, you know, the last two girls at the dance, and that's the guy we go with, I love Frank Vetrano. I know, you know, you have a little bit of exposure if you want to speak on him for a moment, but I was targeting bottom six guys. Now I've just hit the point where I'm memeing on Twitter. I'm doing Bo back because that'd be very funny. I would like Beauvillier back, be in a sense, one, just nostalgia, and two, just like, you know, having a player who can kill penalties, playing your bottom six, hopefully play on your fourth line is what the team needs. Barabanov, Luke Cunning, those are names that come to mind, but nothing. I don't really think there's going to be anyone that's going to cost the Islanders too much at this point. I just hope it's kind of a slow deadline. They keep the assets for the future, and we'll just see where they go from here.
So you mentioned him, and Vetrano is interesting. I think, okay.
Yeah. Okay. It happened. Yeah.
You never know with the internet, but that's cool.
That's awesome. That's how you do it.
Yeah. I mean, there are worse ways to introduce a guy than getting over on the evil corporate people. That works. What was I going to ask about the deadline? What was I going to
ask about? Vetrano.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. The interesting thing about Vetrano is, whenever you look at the underlyings, volume shooter, doesn't create for himself. He's really good as a supporting guy. Like, he riding shotgun with Kreider and Zibanejad was great for him because all he had to do was get open and the puck would find him and he could rip it. In theory, dropping him next to Horvat and Barzal is a fascinating idea. Dropping him next to Nelson and whomstever is a fascinating idea. I just don't think the price is going to be worth what he gets. And I know he's been linked to a few teams, us, the Islanders. I know at one point Edmonton. I know Florida at one point. But the thing about a guy like him is he's never going to really jump off the screen or be the most impressive. So to your point about keeping the first round pick, I don't think he's a guy you give up a one for. Part of the reason he was so good for the Rangers was all he costed was a fourth. Because 2 years ago, he was, you know, a healthy scratch for Florida at times. So I don't think he works there. I mean, if the Islanders were, you know, going to go for something out there, I think the move was somebody in the ilk of the Hanifin sign and trade type, where we're talking about somebody who's going to be here for an extended period of time and fills a need. But being the circumstances what they are, I think you guys probably add a forward, maybe two, as you indicated. And they bank on the guys on the team already improving down the stretch.
Yeah, and you shouted out Duclair earlier. Like, that's fine. A lot of fans want him. He's good. The team's biggest problem right now is keeping the puck out of their own net. Like, you know, you saw what they did against the Bruins last week. They can score four or five for the first time, really, you know, since – what was it, Doug Waite here. It's fun for the first time seeing the offense, but just maybe having someone who can kill a damn penalty would go a long way. That would be awesome. Not too many guys like that on the board, but they come up late. I mean, it's Barry Trotz said earlier this week, it was going to be, you know, the prices are crazy. Looking at the prices right now, they don't seem too crazy. And I think the Islanders could definitely, you know, afford to lose a second or third round pick for some, you know, defensively sound forwards at this point, but we'll see where it goes. I mean, Vetrano is kind of the only where if he's riding passenger with Barzal and Horvat and he has the skate speed to keep up with them, that could be really, really fun because it lets Brock go onto the second line and create another scoring line, and then you're able to go from there. So that's the only long shot, I think, you know, top of the board type guy that they might be in on, but I don't think anyone left, you know, Jake Guentzel's definitely out of their price range. Maybe if Jake DeBrusk finds himself free of Boston, maybe they take him on, but I don't know how he feels about the schools or the Flanders Duck or anything like that. So, you know, it depends. A lot of these guys have no trade clauses. It's always hard to negotiate guys to the island like that. So we'll just see where it goes. I thought maybe Tarasenko was an option, but, you know, he's going to take Florida 8 days a week there.
So opening it up a little bit more, what are you yourself most curious about where we're going as far as the league into the deadline, as far as team, individual player who's still available? What are you most interested to see happen over the next day and a half, 2 days?
Oh, obviously my personal most hated rival and the team I dislike the most, the Pittsburgh Penguins. That is where my eyes are right now. I'm locked in on the Penguins. I'm listening to a Locked On Penguins podcast and just enjoying this every day, which is, you know, good entertainment. There's a lot of good people in Pittsburgh media as well as like the worst of the worst. So it's, I don't want to slander at all, but it's a lot of like Steelers crossover, like, oh, why don't they just try being good? And I'm like, oh yeah, it's a good message to send. But, you know, they've been spoiled for so many years with Crosby and Malkin and being on Mount Pius, where they're like, oh yeah, all you need to do is tank for 5 years and have like two of the NHL's greatest 100 players of all time falling in your lap. So it's been a lot of fun watching them kind of decline. I'm very interested to see what they do at the deadline, how everyone's going to spin it. They wound up getting kind of a boy genius GM through the door. And it's like, you know, no matter what happens this week, they're going to win the deadline, but it's going to be really funny what happens with Guentzel here. Cause if he's going to Vancouver, you figure they're not getting the asset return that it looks like they're getting. But, you know, a lot of teams that are in the mix to win a cup have nothing left in the chamber, and they're going to be trying to fire that at Jake Guentzel. So whatever happens here is going to be really funny, and I'm locked into that chase as we head down the stretch here.
Hey, the Canucks still got 3 days to flip Lindholm.
I know, to a contender. I know that was crazy when that report came out. I was like, oh, CJ just firing blanks. And then today we have Kevin Weeks going, oh, no, we might have a three-way trade. And Boston Bruins finally, after striking out on Horvat, they struck out on Hurdle, they struck out on Eichel, they finally wind up with a big 1C, Elias Lindholm. I don't know what they're doing there, but it's going to be really fun. Whatever happens here, the insiders are firing stuff left, right, and center. Today, the Wednesday, it really picked up. Normally I take off for deadline day. I didn't think it was going to be that fun this year, so probably still work that day, but it's going to be a really fun deadline.
You mentioned the Bruins, and I was talking about this with somebody the other day. How many times do you think it's okay to run it back with the same group and just tinkering around the edges, kind of like the Bruins have done, the Rangers to some extent have done, the Islanders, the Oilers, where it's not a knock on the team's best players. You know, nobody thinks the reason the Oilers aren't breaking through is McDavid or Draisaitl. But when you compose your roster in a certain way, you only get so many permutations you can do around that those specific guys. Is there a specific number of attempts, playoff runs, you think maybe make sense before reconfiguring a team?
I don't know. That's a really good question, because like at the heart of it, it was Boston always had Bergeron and Marchand, so they have to go for it. I remember after we beat them the COVID year, they basically blew their team up. They brought in Foligno, they brought in Holla, they brought in a lot of really weird pieces around the edge, and that team wasn't crazy successful, if I remember correctly, the year after we beat them. But then last year, they tinkered around the edges and wound up with the historic point pace, Swayman breaks through, Allmark breaks through. Absolutely awesome team they had last year where they win the Vezina. You know, they told their team to shoot 12% and save 93%. It's a wicked formula to have. But like this year, they tink around the edges and they're still a pretty good team until this year they start showing cracks in the armor. We'll see where they go next like year. This might be the sign like, okay, it's really time to bring in an influx of talent. But, you know, Elias Lindholm feels like, you know, kind of a middle of the pack guy if that's where they're going to go. The problem is they just never got that kind of Bergeron replacement through the door before Bergeron was out the door. And now they're doing the Vegas winger by committee thing, which Vegas ran with for 4 or 5 or center by committee thing, which Vegas ran with for a while until they finally brought in Jack Eichel and broke through. I think you do need some elite center play to an extent or another, but that's kind of my definition of what makes a contender or a champion in this league. But the Bruins definitely had an elite center. It was just never having a contingency plan for when that elite center left, and even doubling down with that one last year of Krejci there too.
I completely agree with you. I would argue that's been the thing that's held the Rangers back basically my entire life, is they haven't had that great 1C. And they've had great wingers over the years, whether it was Jágr, Nash, now Panarin. They've never had the center that can really swing the game in a way. I mean, they had Islanders legend Derek Brassard, not the same type of great playoff player, but not the same type of guy. Stepan was great. Even Zibanejad, you know, he's a top 70th percentile player in the league. He's good. But, you know, of the 16 teams in the playoffs, he's probably the 18th best center of the teams that are going to go in. So opening it up, talking playoffs, whatever, who do you feel the strongest about as far as just, I think, I don't know if about going all the way, but this team is going to be really serious. This team is dangerous, at least in the East, because it feels like the West, it's going to be a bloodbath. It's not really easy to pick out of there. Who in the East do you feel the strongest about?
The East is a lot harder than the West. In my opinion, I think the West is leaning Dallas. Like, I think Dallas, if they get goaltending for 2 or 3 weeks, they've got this. Everyone's loading up there, but I think, you know, Dallas might be the closest. We'll see where that goes, and maybe that'll be the next discussion point. But looking at the East, I mean, I don't want to slander anyone here, but, you know, Florida's pretty good. They're a really good hockey team, but they might not have the goaltending in the playoffs. There's always a question mark with Bob. Just running down the list here in my head, Boston, I don't know how serious they are. The Rangers look really good right now. We'll see what happens to them. You know, got to give the Devil credit where it's due. They're playing good hockey right now. They're getting the goaltending from Quick and getting it from Igor once again, so they're starting to turn it around. Toronto finally is running their team like a normal human being, so that's interesting to see. We'll see how far that takes them. Trying to think, I guess it would probably be Florida, just kind of handing it to Florida. I don't feel good about the Canes as I normally don't, just because they're betting on Freddie Anderson or Kochenkov or you know, Antti Raanta in 2024 to carry them to the promised land. Flyers are obviously gonna kind of either make it or not make it. We'll see what happens with them. Detroit's, you know, doing the shooting 70% and saving 97% things. We'll see how long that lasts. But there's a lot of interesting teams. I think it has to be Florida and then followed by the Rangers for teams most likely to make it.
All right, so circling back to the Islanders, and we can start to wrap up here. Who do you think gives them the best matchup? And then who do you think is probably their least favorable or the matchup you don't really want to see?
Yeah, my favorite matchup obviously is going to be the, you know, I want the Panthers just for the reason of last year. We got, I mean, look, so there's a couple things to do there. Let me think. So avoiding the Rangers is one
thing. But you always play us well.
The Rangers is such, I know we do. And they're going to play each other 3 more times this year, and they're going to be really good games. I'm very excited to play the Rangers. I'm going to the game the Sunday after this Sunday, which I'm very excited about. I always go to the St. Patrick's Day game when they play. So that's going to be a ton of fun. But, you know, I think the Rangers would be a fun series. It's just there's too much at risk for both.
Oh, that would be hell. There to just that would be break. So bad.
It would be hell. Either way, like it's, you know, my pop's a Rangers fan. It's just like it's not going to work out for me. It's like we'll figure it out. I have good friends that are Rangers fans. I have to keep things civil in the workplace. So it's like that. But, you know, then you go to Carolina. Carolina is I like playing Carolina at this point. I think the Islanders could take them pretty well. And then you open up the Florida. If they're in the other side of the bracket and you beat Florida, then you're getting Boston or Toronto after they play each other. And those teams are about to kill each other in the playoffs. If you get the East, you know, the Rangers versus the Red Wings might not be the best seed if you're in Carolina. So, you know, I feel like if they beat the Panthers, there's a chance to win it all there, you know, and take that side of the bracket. The bracket in the East is going to be really good because the first round is going to be hell for most teams. I don't think we're going to get a sweep in the first round this year. You know, maybe Detroit makes it and gets swapped. Who knows? But we'll see what happens. It's exciting.
Of those, you know, next tier down teams, you know, you mentioned Detroit. We could put Tampa in there for conversation's sake. Do any of those teams interest you in the slightest bit as far as being dangerous? Or do you feel that, you know, Florida is just that much better than everybody else, and the path for a team like Detroit or Tampa is going to be so much harder?
It's interesting because I'm very curious about what Tampa's about to do. They might pivot really hard off Hanifin and do something we're not expecting here at the deadline. You know, that's a general manager who's running his team to win every year, and this is the last year of Stamkos. We'll see if things get messy in the summer, but they're going to probably want to do right by him. So Tampa might have some juice left. I think Detroit's just very juiceless, and this might just be disdain for Kane or the winged wheel and everything, but I can't really see it with them. And then Philly would be the other team in that step down where it's just like, if they make it, it's fun. I know a lot of Flyers fans are rooting to miss it at this point, and I don't like doing that just because I hate wasting seasons. I'm a Mets fan. They made the playoffs 5 years in my lifetime, or made the playoffs five times. I can't miss winning seasons. So that sounds crazy to me, but I get where they're coming from. They're trying to build a good team for when Mishkov comes over. So, you know, it's going to be brutal. They're looking like a first-round exit if they make it, but if it spites their fans and they make the playoffs, that's pretty funny as well.
All right, so last question. I've been doing this with everybody. What is something about the Islanders you would like to talk about?
Oh, things to talk about the New York Islanders. How do you like UBS Arena?
It's very nice. I enjoy the energy. It's kind of – it doesn't totally feel, you know, like straightforward hockey. I've been there for other stuff too. This is going to sound weird, but it kind of feels like a baseball stadium a little bit with, you know, the way the bar is at the one end with the organ and the studio desk. It really kind of has a unique little charm to it. The only thing that's annoying is getting there. Other than that, it's a nice venue. I do like it.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I'm originally from upstate, so it would have been very easy for me growing up to get there by public transit than going to Hempstead. I like it a lot. It's a great arena to go to. I get what you mean, though, with the bars and kind of keeping it a little too open. But, you know, after visiting some of the other arenas in New York and New Jersey, it's definitely my favorite to go to hockey at. I have to see some of the other kind of arenas around the league to get a better vibe for it. But yeah, what do you think the end game here is with Patrick Waugh? Do you think he lasts multiple years with the Islanders? Yeah. Do you think, yeah.
The conspiracy theorist in me says he wants to be the GM and he wants to handpick a coach because that was ultimately kind of what caused the problem in Colorado the first time around, was he wanted more input on the roster. And to be fair, the roster was awful the year he left. And I understand that, you know, it was ultimately the reason, if you believe that narrative, why Trotz wanted to go, was he wanted a little more input on the roster and Lou wasn't willing to give him that. I think that's ultimately the long game. The biggest thing is what Lou does. I don't think Waugh specifically, it's going to come down to him, because I feel like they'll just let Lou keep doing this until he drops dead, because I don't think he'll retire. In all honesty, I don't think Lou is the type of guy who will walk away. I think he will stay on the job until he is no longer on the mortal coil, because this is his life. And I commend his dedication to it. As much as I like to bust balls and make jokes about, oh, he's just going to appoint his son to be the general manager. And then I think ultimately the Waugh arc with the Islanders, which I am curious about, frankly, because the first time around, he was a lunatic in Colorado, just frankly, a lunatic. He seems a little more, I don't want to say tempered, but like he has a better grasp on what he needs to do. I think it being the Islanders as opposed to like Montreal or a bigger market does help, where he's not going to be under the ridiculous hockey microscope. I know you and a few other Islander fans have made the joke that the national media in Canada has been wish casting him to coach another team already, that there are people who are like, he should coach the Habs, even though they have a coach who's, you know, 2 years into their rebuild. I think he's interesting. But ultimately, I think it's going to be a Lou thing more than a Waugh thing.
Yeah, totally agree with you there. I mean, the shouts that it's going to be Chris. I mean, it was fun like to make fun of Chris, but he's definitely doing a job in Bridgeport. I won't say it's a good one, but he would never get, no one would hand him control of their NHL front office. And if it was, it would just still be Lou Ryan. But yeah, no, I mean, were you talking about Waugh? I mean, if you talk about Logan Roy on Succession, that's Lou Lamoriello right now. He's going to be doing this till he drops. I respect him for it. You know, as we saw the discourse online today, people talking about GMs who are players. Lou Lamoriello didn't play the game at the NHL level. He's kind of a hockey lifer through the college ranks. And an original outside voice who's become the hockey man, and eventually it hit a point where it pivoted back to now he's doing the one thing that the 31 other teams aren't doing, which I think is funny. That's always a discussion point on Lou, how he's running this very untraditional franchise by being super traditional. I think that's one of the funny aspects of the Lamorello front office that I do greatly enjoy. Again, not in regards to the facial hair, but just in regards to the cone of silence and, you know, just not willing to wear suits to the game. At a point, it just becomes like, oh no, he's just like throwing his thumb at the league. Like, this is pretty funny. But yeah, it's fun being the Lamorello team with the WAS succession plan. I'm excited to see what happens there. The assistant coach they brought in, I don't want to butcher it, I think it's DeRoche, French Canadian last name, but he's supposed to be a coaching prodigy. We'll see how that goes. If the Islanders maybe go 2 or 3 years with Patrick Wise as the head coach, 2 or 3 successful years, and they want to work his way upstairs. But there's always going to be that apprehension being the Mike Milbury team. That Mike Milbury came in and he came in the fisherman season. He immediately lit like gasoline on fire. The fisherman season's infamous now, and they just got kicked up to the front office. So the guy running the team, as they brought in Rick Bonus and Peter Laviolette and some great coaches that he just couldn't work with and make it work on Long Island. So it's tough. I mean, you know, there's that bad taste in the mouth with turning a coach into a GM and having a player as GM that I don't like either of those things, but we'll see how Pat does. I'm very excited, and he's a great leader of men at the moment until things start going awry, so it's good to hear.
I'll end on this note. At the very least, he makes you feel better. It's one thing when you go up there, like, I know I've watched Devils fans complain for 60 games about how Lindy Ruff inspires no confidence. Ranger fans spent a lot of the last 2 years, Gallant inspired no confidence. Wah, at the very least, even if the team isn't great, he's going to acknowledge the team isn't good. He's not going to bullshit you. And he's going to say, we're going to get better. You know, it really does seem to matter. And I know that that's going to sound corny about a professional coach. Of course it matters. But he takes the time to put an effort into communicating with the media, which a lot of coaches don't, frankly. A lot of coaches at the NHL level treat the media like crap and don't take it particularly seriously. And I do think that matters as a fan, you know, that your coach puts in effort to treat other people with respect that are just trying to do their jobs. It does matter.
No, yeah, I absolutely agree there. And he hasn't scapegoated a young player yet, unlike Lindy and Gallant as well. You know, it might get there eventually, and eventually with Barry Trotz by year 3. I mean, he was such a master motivator, and he was such a great coach to have in the room that, you know, even when he was scratching Wahlstrom, I never really minded it because he's probably making the decision he sees fit. But by year 3, you get sick of that stuff. As long as we're in the honeymoon phase with Wah and it lasts a long time, I mean, you know, you see what's happening with Tocchet in Vancouver. I'm excited to see what the Islanders are with Patrick Wah having an offseason under his belt in a training camp. But at the moment, I just want to get to the finish line on this season, see how far they can make it, and then hope that, you know, maybe 24-25 is the year where they get, you know, a 75% outcome with the group instead of a bottom half outcome. So, you know, they're still in the hunt, but we'll see where it goes.
That'll just about do it for this special Liberty Blue conversation. I want to thank Ryan for stopping by. Make sure you are following him on whatever we're calling that social media platform, at Rat Martin. He's very funny. He's a fellow Mark. We at one point during the recording of this, Kazuchika Okada debuted in AEW. That's why there's an edit at about the 30-minute mark. So if you're still listening at this point, thank you for hanging around. Recording on Thursday when this is going up, and then doing a live deadline show on Friday. Talk to you guys real soon.